Welcome to another episode of Open Doors, Conversations with Heart of the Father. I'm your host, Jacqueline Harper. Open Doors is a conversation about inviting God's love, presence, and power into our hearts. We are friends and teammates from Heart of the Father Ministries who share in the mission of setting captive hearts free through Unbound Ministry. We're so glad you could join us.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Heart of the Father Ministries Open Doors Podcast. I'm Rachel Lozano, and I will be your host today. Joining me today is the wonderful Bonnie O'Neill. You faithful listeners may remember her from our Advent series this past December when she shared her wisdom on the person of Joseph, Jesus's earthly father. For those of you who are new here, or those like me who can't remember what happened yesterday, let alone this past December, I'll give you a little introduction. Bonnie is a spiritual director and the executive director of Alpha Mid-Atlantic, a faith-based nonprofit, and she is a part of the board here at Heart of the Father Ministries. Bonnie is also a hope hunter, and today we get to hear her heart about the reality of what this means when facing a dark valley. So welcome, Bonnie. Thanks so much for joining me today. So I gave a little introduction, but is there anything else you would want people listening today to know about you?
Thanks, Rachel. It's great to be here today. No, I think you covered some of the highlights.
Okay.
I'll share a little bit about my family story, and but we'll wait till it's time for that.
Yeah, and you guys will get to know Bonnie as we go through this podcast. I expect that after listening to this, you'll also want to pick up her book, which also will make you feel like you know her on even a deeper level, which is what I was saying to her before we even started. I felt like I came away from reading this book and felt like, I know Bonnie so much better after reading this. So today's podcast, like I said, we're going to talk about your book, Chronic Hope, where you share about the impact of your son Austin's diagnosis with type 1 diabetes or T1D, right?
That's right.
So, and he was diagnosed at age 5. So I'll say T1D during, I learned a lot about a lot of things, but I really didn't know very much about type 1 diabetes until reading this and just, I mean, how it takes over somebody's life, you know? So, and also one thing I learned is that you can call it T1D. And in getting ready for the podcast today, I got to read Chronic Hope. And this book is really for other parents who have kids who have chronic illness. But I really felt like it offered so much wisdom and insight for myself, even though I'm not a parent mm-hmm. whose child has chronic illness. I think that anybody who reads this book will come away having gained wisdom, having gained insight in a lot of different areas.
That's great, because that means that I achieved my goal.
Good. Well, that's good to hear. So my first question to you is, what led you to write Chronic Hope? Was there a moment in your life where you're like, I need to write this book? Was it a series of moments? What kind of got you to that point where you're like, I need to share my story?
Yeah, so I had written my first book, My Identity is in Christ, a couple of years before, and kind of got the writing bug and was thinking about what might I want to write about next. And, you know, you write about things that you where you've already learned a good bit and you have something to say on this subject. But you also write to discover, you know, to see how are you growing through this experience. And so one of the things I knew extremely well was raising a child with chronic illness, but I didn't really think about writing about it until I was actually very involved as a volunteer and board member with JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and the national organization had me as one of their speakers. And sometimes I would speak on research, but I would also speak on the psychosocial impact of T1D on the family. And so I noticed that every time I would speak on this topic, the room full of parents, there would always be people who were in tears. Mm-hmm. One person actually said, when is your book coming out? Someone else said, are you a therapist? I'd pay to go to you. So it was just this confluence of things like that where I realized I do have something to say about this. And there's not much that's out there that was available for parents of a child with mm-hmm. chronic illness. And so I just thought I really needed to lend my voice to that space, really as a way of giving parents permission to feel what they feel. You know, if your child, especially if your child is ill, you know that they have it so much worse than you do. And so we don't give ourselves the time or the permission to attend to what we're feeling. And so we stay locked in those emotionally dark places. And so I wanted to offer parents hope, really, to move beyond that. And in doing the writing, I've come to realize that we all are stuck in a lot of dark places. I mean, we know that as fans of Unbound Ministry, that, you know, some of these darker places get their claws in us when we're children, and we just sort of push those things aside and don't want to attend to them. And what I learned is that if we want to get out of the cave that we discover that we're in, the only way out is to go deeper in. And so we need to press in. And that's what this book is all about, pressing into those dark places, not to get stuck there, but to get freedom from them.
I love that. And I feel like just listening to you talk about what your hope was for this book, you definitely achieved it, you know? And I feel like the way that you share your heart is so vulnerable. And like you said, giving people permission to feel those things that they feel instead of either pushing them away or pretending that they're not there and then never dealing with them, that you're like, yes, name these. It's okay to feel this way. And you're never going to feel better unless you recognize that you actually have these feelings of anger and frustration and jealousy and all those things.
Right. There's nothing wrong with feeling in and of themselves. It's what we do with them. And so the invitation on the table is to attend to them, to find healing from them.
And I love that. And I even love at the end of every chapter of this book too, Bonnie, she shares a part of her story and then has these great reflection questions. So I feel like not only by sharing your own story are you giving people permission, but then you're giving them questions, probably because you're a spiritual director. They're good questions to help people explore, well, what's going on in your own heart? Can you relate to what I'm saying? And maybe your experience is different, but then go there and find out how you're really feeling about what's going on and dealing with your child's illness.
Yeah, I felt from the beginning that the book, I was not going to tell my story linearly. I wanted to tell it. I tell it in a narrative and reflection style. So it begins with a story, an anecdote of something that happened in my family's life. Usually when I am in a pretty dark place and dealing with one emotion or another, whether it's anger or fear or jealousy or loneliness or bitterness. And then there's a reflection piece that is stepping away from that moment of whenever in the past that episode happened and just providing some wisdom on it. And like you said, then just offering the reader an opportunity to pause and reflect before moving on to the next chapter. How about you? How are you dealing with anger? How do you deal with bitterness? So I really feel like it's a book that is available to really any kind of reader, because we all have these are issues that are common to everyone. Obviously, the target audience is someone with a child with a chronic illness, but you don't have to be in that situation to be able to attend to some of the emotions that you might be dealing with too.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I felt like your book was valuable in a number of ways to me, including insight into friends who are grieving or struggling to care for a sick child. I think that you do a really good job of explaining, here's what's really helpful and here's what can really hurt by either your words or your actions. And I think that's good for people who aren't in your position to hear and to know and to understand. So I feel like I really gained insight into that. And we'll talk a little bit more about what we were talking about too, just also these emotions that we all experience of that fear and that control and the anger. And I feel like you gave a lot of wisdom related to those as well. So maybe I already talked a lot about what you were hoping for readers like me who don't have a child with chronic illness, but did you have a hope for readers who didn't fall into that category, that other people would read this book? What were you hoping for them to get out of it?
For those who don't have a child.
Yeah, so someone like me.
Yeah.
And maybe you weren't thinking about that. Maybe you just thought everyone who would read the book would be in that similar position. I don't know what your thoughts were.
Yeah, no, in the writing process, you kind of visualize a target reader and you have them in mind and they're your bullseye. But then there's the concentric circles outside of that. So my bullseye is parents with a child with T1D. And then the first circle out of that is parents of a child with a chronic illness, and then so on, and until you just get to someone who says, you know, this wasn't the life I expected. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd be farther along in my career by now. I didn't think that my adult children would be going in these different directions that I don't think are healthy for them. I didn't think that my kids would never get along and never want to come back and see me. So there's all different kinds of ways that we can be disappointed with life. And the question I think that Chronic Hope offers is, are we willing to set aside those things, those expectations that we had, and accept what is, or will we continue to try to white knuckle our way through life, holding on to control everywhere that we can, annoying everybody and finding ourselves very discontent all the time? There was a wonderful quote from an author named Dallas Willard, who wrote in his book, Renovation of the Heart, "Self-denial is the fact that not getting my own way does not surprise or offend me and has no control over me." And that was a quote. I've just said that, you know, off the top of my head, because that is something I had to learn and know and internalize and unpack. And what does that mean to not get my way? What does it mean to not be surprised or offended by that? What does it mean that not getting my way has no control over me? So that's some of the attitude that I brought to Chronic Hope. And I think that's just resonates with all of us. It's something that we don't want to do because it's hard, but it ultimately gives us greater interior freedom.
Yep. And I felt like, even before I read the book and I understood the premise, I was like, well, that can speak to me. My life didn't turn out the way I was expecting it.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably very few or maybe nobody whose life turns out exactly the way they're expecting it. And we all as human beings have those similar experiences of our life not turning out the way we expected, having to let go of control and fear and anger. I do want to say this for our listeners, and something that I really took away from the book too, is to not, as we talk about how this book can be good for anyone who's reading it or listening, that I also don't want to cheapen or diminish what you and Austin have gone through. What you have gone through doesn't hold a candle to what I've experienced as a mother, you know, in terms of just the hardship and the scariness of it. You know, I think that's really clear reading this book, that there's just so many times or kind of a constant scariness to, is my child going to survive the day, you know? Yeah. And that you, when they're little, are in charge of that, and then letting go as they get older. So we are going to talk about how your book can speak to the bigger audience. But in that, I don't want it to come across that even though we all can relate to it, that there's something unique and really hard about what you and Austin went through. I'm going to read this quote really fast from your book because I feel like it was really good and I feel like can express better than maybe what I'm trying to say for that. So one of the things you said were, "There are those who play the great equalizer, attempting to support me with the knowledge that every human being has his share of difficulties to deal with in life. And while I know this to be true, I also know this to be true. Just because everyone experiences pain doesn't mean everyone's experience with pain is the same. To pretend that everyone suffers to the same degree in life only cheapens what my son is experiencing. What he has been called to is hard, and what I have been called to as a mother is also hard." So I think that's just a great quote. And I just want to honor you as we move into this. That,
thank you.
Yeah, that you've had a really unique and challenging time.
It is. I feel it's also a gift, though, you know, because when you're given a path that is not what you expected and not what you would have chosen, you can either remain locked in anger and denial and bitterness about it, or you can try to figure out how to be made stronger through it. And I really do think I became stronger as a result of learning how to parent not just my one son with T1D, but all of my kids in a way that forced me to get out of the picture a little bit. That really, I think I had to learn to love them with greater grace and courage than I would have otherwise. There are constant opportunities to get angry when things don't go to plan, and that would happen all the time. Blood sugars never went to plan. My sleep at night never went to plan. I would go to the pharmacy to pick up insulin, and suddenly, you know, there's a new insulin that my insurance plan has decided that we need to use. So nothing was simple. And so the question then is, so with all these multiple opportunities to get angry, am I going to get angry, or am I going to learn how to just go with it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I got it perfect. Not at all.
You don't have it all figured out.
No. But there were so many opportunities to practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were talking about strength and how really you've gained so much strength through parenting Austin and going through that. So I want to touch on, you talk about confusing strength and control. I'm like, oh, that really spoke to me and probably will speak to a lot of you out there that we as human beings, especially parents, can confuse the two. So can you talk a little bit more about that, what that looked like in your life, how we all do that in our own lives?
Yeah, I think before having the challenges of a son with a chronic illness, I thought that being strong was being in control. So that if I got my way, whether it was in a work situation or a family situation or with a relationship, then that meant that I was the stronger one. And I had to come to learn that, similar to what I was sharing about, you know, going to the pharmacy and not suddenly you need new medication or you need to go back home and call the insurance company because it wasn't approved and, you know, you don't have $5,000 to spend for all the medicines. I had to learn that being okay with letting go of my plan actually made me stronger inside. It wasn't so much about how am I presenting myself, am I always getting my way, but how am I internally dealing with not getting my way?
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that that required an awful lot more courage. I feel like the courage that it takes to live a life where you're not in control actually makes you a whole lot stronger.
That's true, yeah. But I think it's so hard to see. Like, I hear you reading in this book, and then even for me, because I've struggled with control and perfection, but getting to the point of recognizing that those aren't things that we want in our lives, like we've held on to them so tightly, and we can't imagine those not being who we are and letting go of them. And those of you who've been listening and know the Unbound model, we talk about that, that sometimes when we're renouncing these things that aren't of the Lord and are enemies, it can feel like we're letting go of a part of ourselves because we've held on to them for so long. So was that your experience as you were letting go of control? Did you feel like you were losing a part of yourself? Or
I think for me, as I was letting go of control, I felt that feeling before. Like, I remember at my first Unbound conference, I remember when Neil, we were going through enunciation and he was naming different types of fear. And when he got to one that was something like fear of disease or fear of sickness, and I felt something visceral in my body of letting go of that, that I knew that that had been because of my family of origin story with this disease, I knew that that had been something I had been carrying for a long time. I think with letting go of control, I think that came much more slowly. And I don't think I really realized the full impact of it until I was writing Chronic Hope.
Hmm.
I've joked with many people after publishing the book that I could have just as easily called it Chronic Control, because that's what it's all about. It's about giving up control. But I think at the same moments as I was giving up control, I was also learning to pick up a gift at the same time. So as an example, and I share this story in the book, my son was taking the train, going up to New York, I think, for the weekend, and realized that he didn't have his insulin.
I remember this story. I'm like freaking out, like reading it.
Where's your supplies? Why didn't you check before you come home from college? And it would have been so easy in that moment to just let go and yell at him. And I realized, though, in that moment that if I do that, I would be beginning to lose permission to continue to be his advocate. He was already at least 20 by this point, when he fully left home and graduated from college. And so there was a greater good at stake. There was, am I going to be basically rehired as his consultant? He's already fired me as the parent. You know, but will I be rehired as his consultant once he, you know, fully reaches adulthood, you know, goes off into the working world? Or will he have said, I have had enough of her badgering? Mm. And so the letting go of control was picking up a gift that I knew I had to cherish for the future. Mm. And also then learning, like, when I finally, and I share this in the story too, when I finally did drop him off at the train station and we just made it by the skin of our teeth, like going to the pharmacy, getting more insulin, the whole thing, I also knew I had to wait on giving him another teaching lesson about what he should have done and could have done and all of that, because that wasn't the time. And he would have just taken whatever I said and just really not paid attention mm-hmm. to it. And so I think for me, what became easier once I realized it was letting go of control, was letting go of something so I could pick up a greater gift.
Mm. I feel like you had so many good points in there. The first thing that really struck me was that those experiences of renouncing our enemies and letting go of things can look really different in our one person, you know, not just from person to person, but in just ourselves. And that you had that really almost like visceral reaction to the fear of disease. And my guess is at that conference, you renounced it mm-hmm. and let it go right in that moment. But there was also something you needed to let go, but that process was slower. And they were both really good, you know, and yeah. the way they attached themselves to you looked different, but you were able to renounce them and let go of them
yeah.
In your own way.
And I know we talk about this at Unbound too, about, you know, sometimes having to go back and receive unbound prayer again, or go back and renounce some things again. And that was something I discovered as I was writing Chronic Hope. I had a bunch of different spiral shells on my desk as I would write, because as I said, I didn't write it linearly. I wrote it like a spiral, where deep in the heart of the book is, in the beginning place, is the caregiver. So if we want to raise emotionally healthy families, we have to begin with emotionally healthy caregivers. So that's where I start the book. And I tell stories throughout that don't go in chronological order. They first tend to the heart of the caregiver, and then that intimate, deep relationship between the caregiver and the one with the disease, and then the couple relationship and the sibling relationship, and then eventually out into the wider world. And so there's freedom that comes in all of those different layers. Some things we need to learn as we keep spiraling out. But one of the things that I learned, and is not surprising to any of your Unbound listeners, is that just when we think we've conquered something like anger or control or fear, we realize that we revisit it again. And it's so surprising, because we think like, oh, I thought I slayed that dragon like years ago. But then it revisits us, or we revisit it, but we're farther out on our spiral toward healing. Mm. And so it looks different, and it might not have such a stranglehold on us that it had before. But we shouldn't be surprised that we revisit it, nor should we be naive to think that, oh, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. We still need to tend to it or renounce it, because we will revisit those same things.
Yeah. And just to normalize that we're going to revisit those mm-hmm. things, because sometimes you can feel ashamed that we've fallen back into those things. And adding shame onto anger and fear and control or whatever else you're dealing with is definitely not going to help you.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
just adding fuel to the fire. In your book, you talk about that fear and that anger. And this was a great quote. You said, my two companions since day one of the diagnosis, so referring to fear and anger, I thought I would move beyond them as one moves through the stages of grief, arriving at acceptance. But here I am, several years later, still cycling in and out of fear and anger. So you mentioned that you think that you've slayed that dragon and it raises its head again. So do you feel like you still struggle with these things? And how do you deal with them? How do you keep it at bay? How do you continue to slay the dragon and move further in your healing journey?
Well, I'm a 6 on the Enneagram. So if anyone knows about that, that means like fear is kind of my constant iterating out to what the possible worst outcome could be. So I still definitely have to deal with fear I think anger is not as much of my go-to as it was in that season. I think the spiritual formation work that I have done and learned through becoming a spiritual director has been enormously helpful. The contemplative work, centering prayer, just learning to be still and attend to the presence of God, that has helped me to just honestly be less prone to anger. Mm. Fear is the one that I still need to deal with always. But I do remember a time during this past year when we were visiting my son in New York, and we couldn't get a hold of him, and my fear radar just went off and completely out of control. Like imagining, this was early on a Sunday morning, not that early, like he should have been up. So I just remember taking that to the Lord and just getting really still, getting present to him and doing some focused prayer, but not the, oh Lord, rescue him. Oh, make him call me. Oh, dear God, please. Oh, not that kind of prayer, but just being still and reminding myself what I've had to so many times when he was younger, that the Lord loves him so much more than I ever will, than I ever could, that he is first and foremost his father's son and not mine. And so things like that, and that really did that, and some deep breathing to kind of calm me down, breath prayers. That was enormously, enormously helpful.
That's awesome. And such a good reminder that we can go through an unbound session, be set free, but we still have to have strategies to hold on to that mm-hmm. freedom and to walk in that freedom. And so you named a number of great strategies of how to do that and to hold on to that peace and the freedom the Lord's given you. So you were just talking about being a spiritual director and all the things you've kind of probably learned on that journey of becoming a spiritual director, and obviously raising a family and going through raising a child with chronic illness. In your book, you talk about really especially right after Austin's diagnosis, struggling in your faith, and that you eventually came back to your faith, but that it did look different when you did. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm sure I know all of us, you know, usually the faith of our childhood isn't necessarily the faith of our adulthood. And so what does that look like for you?
Yeah. So I grew up in a Christian family, loved Jesus from really the moment I met him in one of those itty bitty chairs that you sit in Sunday school, and just always had a really deep, deep love for my Lord. I think it's probably helpful just to know my backstory just a tiny bit, my family of origin. So I'm the fourth child in that family. And my parents, just to tell the story very quickly, they had two children, a son, Johnny, and a daughter, Barb. And Johnny was 8 years old and suddenly got the onset of type 1 diabetes came at the same moment that he had this intestinal virus. And it just really sent his body into a spiral. And he, by the time my parents realized something was wrong and they got him to the hospital, he was already in a diabetic coma, and he passed away 3 days later. And then if you can even imagine, my mother, less than a week later, returned to that same hospital to give birth to my sister, Betsy. So I was born 18 months after the death of my brother to be the child to replace the one that they had lost. And so that, I don't say that lightly, because that was the, I don't know that they necessarily imposed that on me, but that was the role that I imposed on myself, was that I had to make my life matter because Johnny didn't get to live his life. Mm-hmm. I'm living his life. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole other therapy session.
that was a really powerful part of your book when you tell that. I mean, read the book, because really to hear what that was like, I was telling Jen when I read it, I was weeping.
Yeah. Then my sister Barb, the only one who actually knew Johnny, she was then diagnosed with type 1 when she was 16 and I was 8 years old. So from that point on, there was just this fear that gripped our family that my sister Betsy or I would get type 1 diabetes. And to the point where I literally remember breathing a sigh of relief when I turned 25. I'm like, well, I guess I'm too old now, because back then we called it juvenile diabetes.
Right, right.
So I thought, I'm too old to get this disease. But then when I became a mom, you know, you start rethinking about it differently. Like, how will I know these warning signs in my kids? And there wasn't antibody testing yet at that point. So there was nothing you could do to know ahead of time. So when my son, Austin, was diagnosed with type 1, he was 5 years old. I diagnosed him myself at home, just went and bought a urine test kit and discovered to my horror that he had type 1 diabetes. And but we were in the process of moving. Literally, the moving trucks arrived the next day. They didn't hospitalize Austin, which is another whole strange story. So my husband never learned really how to care for him. We moved less than a week later. This was after a five-year period of one medical crisis after another, including surgery for me, not knowing if I had thyroid cancer, including my in-laws living with us for almost an entire school year as we were treating my mother-in-law for an extremely rare cancer, which ultimately took her life shortly after that. And so all this to say, I was just in this emotionally and physically exhausted state when I got this diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. And it hit me so strongly because this was my family disease. This was the disease that, like, we were lived in fear of our whole lives. This happened at a move, a major, major time in my family's life. And it seemed that all of our house moves had just been fraught with disease or trauma of one sort or another. And so I just felt so let down by God. And so I remember standing in my upstairs bathroom a week after we got to Pennsylvania. We moved from Connecticut. I heard this insidious voice in my head say, "So this is the good Christian life?" Hmm. And of course, I know now that that was the enemy, but at the time I didn't. I just bought it hook, line, and sinker. And I looked straight back into that mirror and I just said, "God, go away. If this is the best you can do, I don't want any more to do with you. I've been a good Christian girl. I've lived for you my whole life. I've raised my family to love you, and just go away." And he's such a gentleman, right? Like, he, theologically, I know he was right there, but he allowed this veil that separates us to be just a little bit thicker, so that in that moment when I said, "Go away," everything became dark inside. I don't know how to describe it other than that it was the most quiet, the most dark, the most alone I've ever felt in my entire life. And so that went on for about 2 years. But after 6 months, I'm beginning to understand my son's disease a little bit better. I'm beginning to, you know, see like the sun is shining again. And I started repenting. And I just asked the Lord to forgive me over and over again. But I just couldn't get past this sense of darkness, you know. And again, like, I wanted to just go back to the way things were between the Lord and me, just with a big "I'm sorry" attached to it. But he knew that there was so much more internal healing that I needed to do. He knew that there was this theological stance that I had that I didn't know I was harboring, this if-then theology. If I'm a good Christian girl,
right,
then, and I do my part, then you will do your part and act like the genie in the bottle who grants me all of my wishes. And I didn't realize I was harboring anything like that, but he did. And so he graciously just allowed me to stay in that place of not being able to find him until eventually some friends kind of prayed me out of that in this deep moving prayer experience where we were just praying and I just asked, you know how you can tell like when a prayer is getting ready to wrap up? And it was myself, my husband, and two other friends were praying. And I remember just praying quietly over and over again, "Please, Lord, don't let them stop. Don't let them stop. Somebody has to know what kind of trouble I'm in. Somebody needs to pray me out of this." And so we're about ready to wrap up when all of a sudden my one friend just starts laying in and praying and rebuking the enemy and just praying for Holy Spirit to come and praying for freedom for me. And they didn't really even know what was going on. It was the Spirit that was just guiding him in prayer. And it was just the most beautiful thing. And when we came out of the prayer, I was exhausted and just went to bed because we had
a
flight out of LAX the next morning. But when I woke up in the morning, I knew it had lifted. And it was just like that heaviness wasn't there. The darkness wasn't there. The aloneness wasn't there. And all I can say is, like, during that time, the thing that the Lord kept bringing to me over and over again that I needed to attend to was, is God still good even when life isn't? And so that was what I had to wrestle with. I had to wrestle with that he is a good God, that even if bad things happen to my family and especially to my children, that doesn't mean that he's not a good God. And right. I didn't even know that that was anywhere in there, you know, that I was holding on to that. So I knew in that moment that there would be another testing time and where I would go through another season. I knew it in that moment that there would be another season. Hmm. And that's the chapter called Costa Rica in the book that you can read with a tissue or two.
I read it. Oh my goodness. Yes. Oh, it's some close calls. So
yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I feel like, again, just giving people permission to speak honestly with the Lord, mm-hmm. you know, to not feel bad when we feel those ways and that it will deepen our relationship with him, because it's so clear now how close you are to mm-hmm. him and how mm-hmm. loved you feel by the Lord and that you wouldn't have been able to be mm-hmm. there if you hadn't gone yeah. through that in the first place.
So. And I just want to say to any listeners that if you are experiencing a time when you feel extremely far from the Lord, either because something in your life hasn't gone as you had expected, or just you can't seem to find him, or you feel like you've done some things and there's shame getting in the way there and you just can't seem to find him, that doesn't mean that he's not there. That doesn't mean that you're not still his child. It might be that you were in the place where I found myself, where I was pitting my will against God's. And if you get to that place, just picture Jacob wrestling with the angel, right, in Genesis, and where he cries out to the Lord, don't leave until you bless me. Mm-hmm. And so I would just say that to any of your listeners, just if you find yourself in that place where your will is being pitted against the Lord's, just keep wrestling with him and ask him not to leave you until he blesses you.
Amen. Thank you so much. So we are going to wrap up now. And I do want to close with one question, because I feel like, Austin, I've never met you if you listen to this, but I feel like I know you at least a little bit from reading this book. And I feel like the most recent thing that you wrote about was him leaving for college. And I have a son leaving next year. So that definitely struck me about, you know, a whole nother level. Leaving him, and he ends up being by himself. You know, his roommate doesn't show up, and it's hard. It's very, very hard.
The disaster story.
Yeah. But you mentioned, like, he's graduated now. So mm-hmm. how's Austin doing? What's he up to?
He's great. He's working in New York City in marketing analytics, and he's happy. He's navigating his disease very well. We're just really happy for him. And I think I've been rehired as his consultant.
good. Doesn't that happens, right? They become adults. They come back
They realize you do know a few things. And you're worth getting advice from.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Bonnie. And every time I talk to you, I feel like you have so much wisdom to offer. I felt that way during our Advent podcast, and I feel that way now too. So thank you.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you to all of you listening today. It is a joy to know you are joining us each week. So if you'd like to see us in person and not just listen to us on our podcast, in September, there's going to be an Unbound conference in Baltimore. And then in October, we're going to have an Unbound conference in Morton, Pennsylvania. So both of those, you can find out more information on our website, heartofthefather.com, or there'll be a link in our show notes. So definitely sign up for those. We'd love to see you. So God bless you and have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you'd like to learn more about taking hold of the freedom you have been given in Christ, check out our website, heartofthefather.com, and find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Matt,
Jen,
Rachel,
and Jacqueline saying goodbye until next time.
Behold, I stand at the door and knock.
If anyone hears my voice and opens the door,
I will come in to him and eat with him.
And he with me. Revelation 3:20.